This message comes from NPR sponsor Literati Kids. Great children's books open up new worlds.
Live from NPR News, I'm Korva Coleman. The Biden administration says it will seek to buy an additional 200 million more doses of COVID-19 vaccines. The White House wants to have enough vaccines to inoculate the entire adult population in the U.S. by the end of the summer. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports it's also seeking to increase vaccine doses to states.
The Biden administration says states should expect additional shipments of the vaccine within the next several weeks, following complaints of shortages. In an effort to speed up distribution, the president says the government will purchase an additional 100 million doses each of the two approved vaccines for COVID-19.
We will increase overall weekly vaccination distributions to states, tribes, and territories from 8.6 million doses to a minimum of 10 million doses.
Biden reiterated.
Говорит Радио Свобода. Радио Свобода. Новости.
В Москве 14 часов. У микрофона Юлия Митюхина. Госдума сегодня ратифицировала продление на 5 лет действия договора о сокращении стратегических наступательных вооружений. СНВ-3 – единственное соглашение между Россией и США об ограничении вооружений. Срок его действия заканчивался в начале февраля. Документ предусматривает, что каждая из сторон сокращает свои запасы ядерных боезарядов и их носителей. Администрация бывшего президента США Дональда Трампа настаивала на замене СНВ на новый трехсторонний договор, к которому должен был присоединиться и Китай. Москва настаивала на продлении договора на 5 лет в существующем виде. ФСБ объяснила появление бесполетной зоны над особняком под Геленджиком возросшей активностью иностранных разведок. Об этом спецслужба заявила в ответе на запрос редакции РБК. Ранее расследователи из Фонда борьбы с коррупцией связали дом с президентом России Владимиром Путиным. Бесполетная зона в районе села Просковеевка была установлена приказом Минтранса от 24 июля прошлого года в интересах пограничной безопасности, утверждается в ответе ФСБ. Но на самом деле ограничения полетов были введены еще в 2011 году. Запрета на прохождение лодок в районе мыса нет, настаивают в ведомстве. В Москве сотрудники ФСБ задержали тикток-блогера Константина Лакеева. Об этом сообщает ОВД «Инфо». По данным ТАСС и БАЗа, Лакеева задержали по делу о нападении на служебный автомобиль ФСБ на несанкционированной акции в Москве 23 января. Источник агентства уточнил, что задержанного привезли в отдел полиции. По информации СМИ, вместе с Лакеевым задержали еще не менее десятка тикток-блогеров. По словам источника ТАСС, на допрос увезли тех, кто мог находиться вместе с Лакеевым на акции. У Лакеева более 800 тысяч подписчиков. В Москве, Петербурге, Самаре, Красноярске, Тобольске и Ростове-на-Дону сотрудники правоохранительных органов опрашивают школьников, принявших участие в акциях в поддержку Навального. Об этом сообщили Коммерсанту в апологии протеста и правозащиты «Открытки», отметив, что допросы проходят с присутствием родителей, но далеко не всегда с адвокатом. В Петербурге, как пишет издание, школьников спрашивают, не предлагали ли им деньги за участие в протестах, а также выясняют, видели ли они в соцсетях призывы выйти на акции или, наоборот, воздержаться от участия в них. Министры иностранных дел стран Большой Семерки и глава внешнеполитического ведомства ЕС Жозеп Боррель призвали российские власти немедленно и без всяких условий освободить Алексея Навального и всех задержанных на акциях против его ареста 23 января. Министры осудили политически мотивированный арест Навального и призвали российские власти придерживаться своих международных обязательств и соблюдать права человека. Это была цитата. Московский областной суд рассмотрит апелляцию на решение суда в Химках, по которому Навального отправили на 30 суток в СИЗО уже в четверг, 28 января. Об этом сообщил адвокат Владимир Кобзев. Слушания пройдут в подмосковном Красногорске. Пока не ясно, доставят ли в суд самого Навального. Он находится в СИЗО «Матросская тишина» в Москве. Мэр Москвы Сергей Собянин в очередной раз смягчил ограничительные меры, введенные в российской столице из-за пандемии коронавируса. Об этом Собянин сообщил в своем блоге. С 27 января отменяется запрет на ночную работу для ресторанов, баров и других развлекательных заведений. Требования для работодателей о переводе не менее 30% сотрудников на удаленный режим становятся рекомендательным. Обязательным оно остается для людей старше 65 лет и тех, у кого есть хронические заболевания.
Welcome to The Intelligence on Economist Radio. I'm your host, Jason Palmer. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. A telling tech tussle is going on down under. Australian authorities have drawn up plans to extract money from giants such as Facebook and Google for linking to news websites. It's a battle long in the making that may set a global precedent. And there's one thing dominating the public discourse in Egypt these days: filthy baked goods. News of some risque cakes went very, very viral earlier this month, and the reaction reveals a lot about how the country is being run. But first, while the likes of America and Britain are racing ahead with vaccine programs, most of the 27 member states of the European Union have barely left the starting blocks. By last week, the EU had vaccinated 1.4% of its population. In Britain, it was 7%. In America, 5%. And after that sluggish start, the bloc looks like it'll be further hampered by a cut to supply. AstraZeneca and Pfizer-BioNTech have both said production problems will preclude them from meeting the expected numbers. The EU says it will tighten export controls and is threatening legal action. The president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, urged the companies to meet their promises.
Europe invested billions to help develop the world's first COVID-19 vaccines, to create a truly global common good. And now the companies must deliver. They must honor their obligations.
AstraZeneca has defended its efforts, partly blaming the EU for delays in signing the contract. The EU, for its part, hasn't yet approved the AstraZeneca vaccine. That's expected to happen on Friday, a month behind Britain. The European Commission had set a goal of inoculating 70% of Europe's adults by the summer. It's a target that looks increasingly unlikely.
I think the best way to describe how Europe is progressing with its vaccination program is sporadically.
Sophie Petter is our Paris bureau chief.
Each European country has delegated all the buying, the distribution of vaccines and the authorization for them to European authorities, which means that each country ought to be at the same point. But if you actually look at what's happening on the ground, that's not the case. It's a very patchy picture.
And why is that?
Well, you're dealing with 27 different health systems, and health is something that is not managed at the European level. It's managed by each country. Each of those systems is different. They tend to be quite centralized in some cases. If you take France, that would be a good example, or decentralized, as in Germany. And each system has its, you know, benefits in some cases. During the early months of the pandemic last year, it was actually thought to have helped Germany to have such a decentralized system. But now Germany seems to be finding it difficult to get out the vaccine. That's starting to look like a disadvantage. So it really is this patchwork of different health systems and different campaigns that I think explains the differences across the continent.
Rather than anything logistical or plain mistakes being made?
Well, it's quite hard at this point to start talking about mistakes being made. There are clearly supply issues, and that is something that has come right to the top of the agenda for the European Union this week. So there is a lot of complaints about delays to the Pfizer vaccine that was already known. There are now concerns about delays to the AstraZeneca vaccine, which hasn't actually even been approved yet by the European Medicines Agency. That's expected to happen very shortly. So there are supply issues. There are also logistical issues in some countries. It's certainly been very difficult, as everyone is discovering the distribution of the Pfizer vaccine is complicated, but it's not beyond the capacity of countries. It depends a lot in how well they were organized in advance and how pragmatic they've been able to be in responding to the sort of bottlenecks that are appearing in their distribution systems.
And in what countries have all of these difficulties focused the hardest, do you think?
Well, it's sometimes quite surprising. One of the countries that has taken a really long time to get its act together over the vaccination program is actually France, which is thought of as having this fabulously efficient health system, which costs them a lot, but on the whole is in normal times extremely effective. But actually, France has been one of the slowest countries to get its vaccination program rolling out. I visited the vaccination center in a town called Poissy, which is about 30 kilometers outside Paris, which was the first vaccination centre to open outside a care home or a hospital in France. And in fact, what really struck me talking to the mayor there and about how he'd gone about opening this centre was that in order to get round the rules imposed by an extremely bureaucratic centralised system, you've got to take the initiative, you've got to keep hitting the phones, you've got to call up, you've got to say, we're ready, please give us authorisation and we will start vaccinating. Because otherwise, you'll find that a lot of people on the ground are just waiting, or at least are used to waiting for instructions to come down from on high. And what I saw in Poissy was the exact opposite of that, and how actually people on the ground can make a difference if governments are able to sort of incorporate them into the process.
And what about the wider picture in Europe, the reaction to the evident slowness, the complicated nature of the rollout so far?
I think there is an increasing sense that Europe has to get its act together and needs to now respond and to step up its vaccination program. But there are various problems. One of them is the supply. That's now being dealt with at the European Commission level. So there are some pretty tense conversations going on with the pharma companies involved. And then on the ground, it's a question of trying to contain the impatience and also the sense of exhaustion among a lot of European populations. We've seen that with the Netherlands, for example, where there's been rioting in response to the imposition of a curfew in the evening. France has been under a curfew since the middle of December. That means every single night people are supposed to be in their homes now by 6 p.m. in the evening. And I think that there's a sort of very difficult management of expectations for political leaders at the moment, trying to balance on the one hand this sense that there is light at the end of the tunnel with vaccines, but equally trying to get the people to sort of get through these next weeks and months, which are going to be extremely difficult while waiting for those vaccines to come online.
But even with the best will of the world, you still need to have the vaccines. And you mentioned that there is some question around supply now.
Yes, absolutely. And that's why these discussions that are taking place this week between the European Commission and, in particular, both Pfizer but also AstraZeneca are going to be so important. There's a sense of deep frustration that the orders that have been placed by the European Commission, which thought that it was acting on behalf of, in a sense of sort of solidarity on behalf of all its 27 member states, in ordering these vaccines, in making sure that they could guarantee the supply on a fair basis to every country, that's now in jeopardy because AstraZeneca says it won't be able to deliver as expected. The EU is considering whether to retaliate with export restrictions on the Pfizer vaccine, which is produced in Belgium, one of the EU member states. And this could get quite nasty in the sense that vaccine nationalism, which is something we haven't seen until now, could be beginning to rear its head.
Sophie, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jason.
What's the best mattress for you? Well, if you're an egg or a kitten, check out the competition. But if you're a human person...
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. On yesterday's show, my colleague Donald G. McNeil Jr. spoke with Dr. Anthony Fauci about the Trump era of the coronavirus. Today, with President Biden inaugurated, vaccine distribution well underway, and multiple variants of the virus beginning to spread, an update from Donald on the state of the pandemic. It's Wednesday, January 27th.
So, Donald, I want to start by thanking you for interviewing Dr. Fauci. You're not a bad host, I have to say. You're a pretty good host.
It's just asking the question and then shutting up.
Well, not everyone's capable of that. And I wasn't certain you were capable.
But you were. You cut out a lot of my long stories that I would sort of, wind up, after asking the question. So, I appreciate that. You also cut out some of my swearing, so I appreciate that too.
Well, again, we really appreciate it. Because your conversation with Fauci did such a good job of establishing where we have been and what it was like to try to fight the virus under the previous administration, I want to talk about where we are right now. So describe this moment in the pandemic for us. What is happening right now?
So we're seeing sharp declines in new cases. They're down by about 33% from 260,000 a day in early January to about 170,000 now.
It's a big decline.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Decline by a third is a big deal. We're seeing hospitalizations down by about 10%, and we're seeing deaths down by about 10%.
How do you explain that?
Well, we've seen this before in that we've seen cases rise and then drop. We saw that right over Thanksgiving. We saw it right over Christmas. And now we're seeing it where it rose until January 9th and then began to drop. Now, those might have been false starts in a way in that Thanksgiving, a lot more people got tested in order to get on airplanes for Thanksgiving travel.
Right.
And of course, you pick up some cases that way. Then you saw the same thing at Christmas, Christmas travel again. Then on January 9th, it started going down. And, you know, January, February is not a time when Americans go on holiday travel very much. And so this might be the real thing. You've got a fairly steady level of testing, but the number of positive cases in that steady level of testing begins to go down and is now going down pretty substantially.
And when you say the real thing, Donald, that's a very tantalizing concept. Does that mean that finally we've turned a corner in the pandemic? What do you mean when you say the real thing?
I mean it's not an artifact of testing for holiday travel and then a lag.
Right.
There really are fewer cases each day in the United States. And we see that state to state to state. Literally, every state except Rhode Island is seeing a decline in cases. So this looks like we really are seeing a turning point in the trajectory of the virus, that the number of cases has gone up to a peak and look like it's coming down. We've reached the point now where about a third of the country has been infected. If you look at the total number of cases, 25 million cases, basically most epidemiological models now multiply that by about four to get the number of real infections we have in the country. So roughly we're between 100 million cases and 110 million cases, actual infections, including the asymptomatic ones, which means that about a third of the country has been infected.
Wow.
And when you reach the point in any herd, in any population, where about a third of it is infected, the virus doesn't stop, but the virus begins to slow down. Because in any herd, whether it's a bunch of horses in a corral or it's a bunch of people in a bar, about a third of them are immune to the virus. So the virus can't just ricochet through that crowd as fast as it did months ago when everybody was susceptible to it.
So behind this good news decline in the pandemic is the kind of awful reality that the coronavirus has run wild through the United States and infected a third of our population and rendered a third of our population essentially immune.
And some of them dead.
Right.
When people were talking months ago about reaching herd immunity, that was the argument. Do we hide people away to protect them, or do we reach herd immunity by letting the virus wash through us? Just let her rip. Well, it's been let rip, and the consequence is we've got about 400,000 dead. So it's costly.
Very costly. So, Donald, this major decline in new cases in the United States, it is coinciding with the emergence of multiple variants of the coronavirus. And I want you to catch us up on those variants. What is the significance of them? How many are they? How meaningfully different are they from each other? And how are they going to interact with this decline in new infections?
Okay. There is a British variant, a South African variant, a Brazilian variant, something called the California variant. And we know different amounts about each one of these. We know the most about the British, a little bit more about the South African, less about the Brazilian, less about the American or Californian one. The British one appears to be about 50% more transmissible than the standard variant in the United States.
Right.
Meaning 1.5 times as likely to infect somebody. Because it's got a mutation on the spike protein and in the receptor binding domain of the spike protein that makes it better able to attach to cells. That same mutation is in the South African variant and in the Brazilian variant, but they have additional mutations. Hmm. And those additional mutations make it look as though they might partially escape the vaccines and might partially escape the body's immune response, which would mean you might, in theory, get infected with them again, even if you've already had the virus before. That sounds scary.
It absolutely sounds scary.
It's not total. I mean, something can have a weaker response to a vaccine or a weaker response to the body, but not be totally negated. And so people shouldn't panic. I mean, we think of the spike protein as looking like a spike or the tip of a spear because right. that's the way it's drawn when you see it. But really, it's not. It's this long string of 1,300 amino acids that then folds and balls itself up into this giant wad of what looks like a bundle of telephone wire and things like that. And when antibodies attack, they kind of work their way through this tangle of telephone wire and glom onto bits of the protein. And if you change the shape of the protein, some of the antibodies may not be able to make their way through this jumble of telephone wire and attach where they normally attach, so you get a weaker antibody response. Doesn't mean your response is totally wiped out. It's as if you had, you know, no armor, and now you've got armor with a bunch of holes in it. Well, some arrows can get in and some arrows can't. You can still be killed, but it may be harder.
Hmm. So just to summarize, the mutations in the Brazilian and South African variant, they have created a shape of spike that just makes it harder for these antibodies to find their way to where they're supposed to go to damage that spike and make it harder for the virus to infect us.
Yes, that is the prevailing theory as to what these mutations are doing, that they are changing the way the protein folds, which changes the ultimate shape of the protein once it's all balled up. Now, we know that all three of these variants are more contagious. The question is, are they more lethal?
Mm-hmm.
There was a controversial statement made by Prime Minister Boris Johnson in England the other day saying that the British variant might be a third more lethal. But that's based on very preliminary evidence, and his own scientists said, hey, let's not say that clearly. That's spreading panic. The other two variants, if they are better able to escape vaccines or better able to escape the counterattack from our immune systems, might indeed be more lethal, somewhat more lethal, but we don't know that yet. It's an assumption you'd make, but we don't have the data to prove it. Are more contagious. The question is, are they more lethal?
Mm-hmm.
There was a controversial statement made by Prime Minister Boris Johnson in England the other day saying that the British variant might be a third more lethal. But that's based on very preliminary evidence, and his own scientists said, hey, let's not say that clearly. That's spreading panic. The other two variants, if they are better able to escape vaccines or better able to escape the counterattack from our immune systems, might indeed be more lethal, somewhat more lethal, but we don't know that yet. It's an assumption you'd make, but we don't have the data to prove it. And remember, we're talking about sort of fractionally more lethal. We're not talking about COVID-19 becoming the Black Death. We're talking about a slightly more dangerous virus. And of course, treatments are getting better and hospitalization, you know, getting better. So hopefully we can overcome that.
Mm-hmm. So before we get to how these variants are going to complicate the question of treatment and vaccination in the U.S., I just want to return to these declines in new infections, because it would seem like these more contagious variants will be jeopardizing those significant declines that you just described. That seems almost inevitable.
It is inevitable. It is what scientists are afraid of. They are afraid that if we don't vaccinate people fast enough, that the British variant will spread and become the dominant variant. The CDC has already predicted that that will happen by March. And that means new infections will speed up. And it's now becoming a race between vaccinating people and the spread of the variant. And the fear is that if the variant spreads faster than the vaccine can, you'll see cases begin to go up again towards another peak.
We'll be right back.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Senate lawmakers will consider more of President Biden's cabinet nominees today. NPR's Giles Snyder says they include Pete Buttigieg to be the next transportation secretary.
The Senate is working through President Biden's nominations at a comparatively slower pace. The administration still lacks permanent leaders in key cabinet posts, including at the Departments of Justice and Homeland Security and at the CIA. But the Senate Commerce Committee is set to decide whether to advance Pete Buttigieg's nomination. While the Commerce Panel votes, two others will be appearing for their confirmation hearings, former Michigan Governor and Energy Secretary nominee Jennifer Granholm and Linda Thomas Greenfield, Biden's nominee to be the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. Later in the afternoon, former President Obama's second-term Chief of Staff, Dennis McDonough, has his confirmation hearing to be Veterans Affairs Secretary. Giles Snyder, NPR News.
A vast majority of Senate Republicans appear unlikely to support a conviction of former President Trump at his upcoming impeachment trial. Yesterday, all but five GOP senators voted in favor of dismissing the case against Trump in a procedural vote. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky is among Republicans who argue an impeachment trial for an ex-president is unconstitutional. The article of impeachment accuses Trump of inciting insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. That's when his supporters stormed the building. That trial is set to begin the week of February 8th. A conviction requires a two-thirds majority in the Senate. Later this morning, the Biden administration will hold its first of three weekly briefings on the coronavirus. Scientists will be updating the public about efforts to control the spread and efforts to get more people vaccinated against COVID-19. The Federal Reserve is expected to leave U.S. interest rates alone when the Fed wraps up its latest policy meeting today. NPR's Scott Horsley says rates are expected to remain near zero amid the pandemic and millions of lost jobs.
Fed Chairman Jerome Powell has made it clear he and his colleagues will continue to do what they can to support the U.S. economy as it continues to recover from the coronavirus recession. While unemployment has fallen since the early months of the pandemic, there are still millions of people out of work. The booming job market that was lifting wages and pulling workers off the sidelines just a year ago remains a distant target. With inflation stubbornly low, there's no pressure on the Fed to raise interest rates. Powell says a jump in consumer demand could trigger price hikes once the pandemic's under control, but those are likely to be temporary and not a source of alarm for the central bank. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Dozens of companies are reporting their latest earnings numbers this week, including American Express, Apple, and GE. This is NPR News from Washington. Teachers in Chicago's public school system won't be returning to their classrooms this week, as the city's mayor had hoped. The teachers' union says its members still have coronavirus safety concerns. The union wants broader vaccinations and more testing before teachers return for in-class instruction. Professors at the University of Kansas are voicing objections to a new policy that makes it easier for the university to fire tenured faculty members. Stephen Basaha reports from Wichita.
The Kansas border region says it's considering using the new policy to get around tenure protections, citing severe budget problems made worse by the pandemic. The state's governor has proposed cutting funding for higher education. Faculty Senate President Luah Kamal Yul says the change would lower the quality of education at the university.
And it tells students that we're willing to turn the education business into a fast food joint.
Most public universities in Kansas have vowed to uphold tenure protection. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Bisaha in Wichita.
The National Weather Service says Monday night's tornado that struck north of Birmingham, Alabama, was at least an EF2. That means it had winds of 135 miles per hour. That tornado killed one person and injured at least 30 others in the Fultondale area, some critically. The person killed is identified as a 14-year-old who'd moved with relatives to the basement of their home when it collapsed. The tornado left a 10-mile path of destruction through Birmingham's suburbs. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
The Community Secretary Robert Jenrick says the Prime Minister wants to set out a roadmap out of the lockdown in England in the coming weeks. A senior government source said decisions would be based on the number of people who are in hospital and dying of coronavirus, the success of the vaccination programme, and any further mutations of the virus. Mr. Jenrick indicated that ministers would retain the system of regional tiers.
Education will continue to be our priority throughout the pandemic. We've done everything we can to keep schools open. And I think we will also try to make use of the tiered system because we have seen in the past, and I suspect we'll see in the future, variances in cases in different parts of the country. If we do see that, then of course it's sensible that we target restrictions on those places where the virus is most prevalent.
The Community Secretary also defended the government against criticism that it had acted too slowly since the autumn to prevent the total numbers of deaths in the UK from passing 100,000. He said the Prime Minister had taken decisive action in England when it became apparent the tiered system wouldn't be sufficient to tackle the new variant of coronavirus. Girls experience a sharper decline in well-being and self-esteem than boys, according to new research. The report by the think tank the Education Policy Institute and the Prince's Trust says the government must improve mental health support for schools. More from our education correspondent, Sean Dilley.
Children's mental health, the report authors say, is a crisis that's likely to be made worse by lockdown and school closures in England because of increased isolation and fewer opportunities to exercise. The researchers found that very frequent use of social media had a negative effect on the well-being of all children, but impacted the self-esteem of girls more. The Department for Education has said it is aware of the impact lockdown is having on young people's well-being. It said it planned to announce details of a mental health action group soon.
Bailiffs and police have started an operation to evict climate change campaigners who've barricaded themselves into tunnels dug underground at Euston in London. The group, who are called HS2 Rebellion, spent months building a tunnel network to try to stop work on the high-speed rail link. A set of 10 hand-drawn maps which chart the defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1588 have been saved for the nation after a £600,000 fundraising campaign. The ink and watercolour parchments have been sold to a private collector in the United States, but will now go on display at the National Museum of the Royal Navy. Andrew Baines from the museum says they're an important part of British history.
I think these maps are really hugely significant for the story of England and by extension Great Britain and the United Kingdom and for the origins really of the Royal Navy and broader naval history. So they're really, really significant for the naval story, the story of our country, who we are, where we've come from.